Thank you. Speaking of the local website, I noticed last night that a number of recent sermons and Bible studies are on there. Is that correct? Okay. I was kind of taken aback by that because I didn't realize that. So I'm going to have to be a lot more careful about what I say because who knows who might be listening. So, you know, last week I spoke to the young adults on the subject of suicide because, you know, I mentioned last week that the young man whose memorial is tomorrow took his own life, and you know, that's the second time in a year that a young person that we know and has taken his own life, and it's not the second time in my ministry, unfortunately. There's been quite a few cases of that over the last 30 years in the ministry, and of course it's always you know, very sad and you know, very distressing. And I wanted to just get across to the young people, especially the young guys, because it's much more common amongst young men, some points regarding this. So that's going to be on the website. And I'm kind of pleased that this one's going to be on the website too, because I think that there is benefit here for people beyond our congregation. 1 Timothy chapter 3 gives us the qualifications of an elder. And there's something there that I've been thinking about somewhat lately. I want to share it with you. 1 Timothy chapter 3 is an interesting, a particularly interesting verse, which I feel I understand far more now than when I was first ordained almost 30 years ago. 1 Timothy chapter 3, beginning in verse 1, we'll begin there and I'll read through it. And while you're turning there, I'll just remind you that I'm leaving for Ghana on Thursday and will be gone until January the 7th. I'll be back for the first Sabbath in January, but I'll be gone for 15 days. 1 Timothy chapter 3, this is a faithful saying. If a man desires the position of a bishop, he desires a good work. So, you know, a bishop in Greek is an overseer. In fact, in the Greek Empire, bishops were administrators. It was not a religious thing at all. It was purely secular. So it just means somebody who rules over an area. But in the context in which it appears here, it is talking about somebody who is in the ministry, so an elder. A bishop then must be blameless, the husband of one wife, temperate, sober-minded, of good behavior, hospitable, able to teach, not given to wine, not violent, not greedy for money, but gentle, not quarrelsome, not covetous. Then we come to this verse, verse 4, one who rules well his own house, having his children in submission with all reverence. For if a man does not know how to rule his own house, how will he take care of the children of God, or the church of God? Now in Victorian times, this particular passage was interpreted to mean that the father must be severe, strict, and remote, in absolute control over all those in his household. Remember, some time ago, I mentioned that in Webster's original 1828 dictionary, the definition of family was rather interesting. I looked it up a few weeks ago for a sermon that I gave on a different subject. And the definition of a family was a husband or father with the wife, mother, their children, and servants. And it was the custom 100 years ago, even in this country, for professional people, for, you know, people who had who owned their own homes and had servants, and the majority of professional people would have had live-in servants. We're not talking about factory workers here. We're talking about, you know, professional people would have had their own servants who lived in their homes. And if you go in some older homes, you'll find where the servants' quarters are. They're usually right up at the top on the third floor. But even the servants had to join in family prayers and Bible readings. That was the custom. And that would be at least once a day and sometimes twice a day, usually morning and evening. And the father, the head of the family, the head of the household, would lead everybody in prayer and Bible study. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, rather interestingly, points out the same thing, and that's a commentary that was written less than 200 years ago. But let's look more closely at that word, rules. one who rules his own house well. Strong's Concordance shows this word comes from the Greek word proistemi, or proistemi, P-R-O-I-S-T-E-M-I, meaning to stand before, that is, in rank, to preside over, to practice, maintain, be over, to rule. That's the definition of this particular word. To preside over, to practice, to maintain, to be over. In other words, the one who is in charge. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says this, that the Greek word here, ruleth, quoting from the King James, means presiding over his own house. And it says, this is referring to children and servants as contrasted with the church. So again, when Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown's commentary was written, it was common again for, and Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown's commentary was written about the same time as Noah Webster's dictionary, you know, the family was considered to include the servants. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown sums up the passage this way, how shall he who cannot perform the lesser function perform the greater and more difficult? So how could somebody possibly run a church or rule over a church if he cannot rule over his own family? And then we have to ask the question, well, how does the head of the family preside over the family? Well, I think we have an answer to that biblically. And, you know, I don't think this was always followed back in those days in the 1800s. But in Ephesians chapter 5, we see the answer to that. And hopefully you're all following my logic here as we look at this particular scripture. In Ephesians chapter 5, the Apostle Paul helps us to understand exactly what the husband and father's responsibility is. Just as in 1 Timothy 3, he compared the role of a pastor to that of a father. Here in Ephesians chapter 5, verse 25, husbands, love your wives, just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for it, that he might sanctify and cleanse it with the washing of water by the word, that he might present it to himself a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that it should be holy and without blemish. So husbands ought to love their own wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. For no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it, just as the Lord does the church. So the emphasis here is clearly on leading in love. And if we use that analogy with the role of a bishop or a pastor, then the same thing applies there. The sermon of my title, the title I gave this sermon is Rule Well in Love, and that's what I want to just dwell on here. Look at 1 John chapter 4. 1 John chapter 4. 1 John chapter 4 and verse 8. You know, when you think about some of those marriages in the 1800s, you look at some of the pictures that are still left. The camera was invented in 1840, so that was a little bit after Noah Webster's dictionary came out. But if you look at some of those early photographs, in fact, photographs taken of families right up until the early 1900s, you know, often father would look very severe, and the emphasis definitely was on, you know, being very strict and everything. And, you know, there's a time for that, but, you know, I think they erred too much in that direction, as a result of which now we've gone too much in the other direction. So, you know, we need to get the balance. But, you know, I want to concentrate on just this one point of ruling well his own house and see exactly what we can learn from this. In 1 John 4 and verse 8, it says, he who does not love does not know God, for God is love. So God is love, and that's, you know, how God is summed up here by the Apostle John. And John, remember, was closer to Jesus Christ than any of the other disciples. John's gospel reveals more about Jesus Christ, who he was and where he comes from, than, you know, any other of the gospels. So, you know, John certainly had that closer relationship with Jesus. And here he writes, he who does not love does not know God, for God is love. 1 John chapter 3 and verse 16, again, helps us understand this. By this we know love, because he laid down his life for us. And we also ought to lay down our lives for the brethren. But we know love, and this is agape love, godly love. By this we know love, because he, Jesus Christ, laid down his life for us. So that was a great lesson in love for each and every one of us, and helps us to understand what love is. And it is giving to others and sacrificing for others. I was preparing this yesterday, and Alex arrived yesterday at lunchtime. I hadn't prepared the sermon in time. You know, now that we have a granddaughter, or we have two granddaughters, but now whenever any one of them is coming over, we have to clear up just about everything. Because whatever isn't picked up is soon ripped up, thrown up on, or just shredded, or something. I had this pile of papers that I've been waiting to go through and wanted to go through before I go to Ghana next Thursday. I don't need to anymore, because unless I got into them all, and I just thought, I can't go through them all. They're all kind of soggy, and, you know, I don't want to go through them all. I'll just throw them all out. But, you know, babies, you know, if you're going to be a successful parent, you've got to have a lot of love. Because, you know, young children need 24/7 attention, and it can be really tiring, and I think a lot of people are not prepared for it when children come along, but of course there are blessings that come from children as well. Couldn't think of any yesterday, but there are. No, I could. It's a sweet girl, but by this we know love, because he laid down his life for us. And, you know, I think we can understand that as parents, that we would lay down our lives for our children. You know, we wouldn't hesitate to do that, to protect our children and to provide for our children. And, of course, Jesus Christ laid down his life for us. And so in following his example, we also ought to lay down our lives for each other, for the brethren. To serve each other and to give to each other and to help each other. Jesus Christ showed more love than anybody else who has ever lived. Even though he was perfect, he laid down his life for us to pay the penalty for our sins, not his own sins. John chapter 13, another verse here written by the Apostle John. John chapter 13 and verses 34 and verse 35. A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another. And, you know, just imagine how revolutionary this was at this particular time. You know, we checked out a few days ago the movie The Message. And I don't recommend it to anybody unless you really want to understand Islam. It's about the beginnings of the Islamic religion, about Muhammad. And the movie was actually approved by four major Islamic centers, one in Cairo, one in Jordan, I think, one in Saudi Arabia. And it says at the beginning that although the whole movie is about Muhammad and the beginnings of Islam, they cannot show pictures of Muhammad. That's against their religion. So therefore, whenever Muhammad's in it, everybody's looking at him or looking at the camera, and you don't actually hear anything. But what really struck me, what stood out in the movie was, you know, they were trying to present a very positive image of Islam. And this was made, by the way, in 1976, and it's about 3 hours long. So it's a dramatized film account of the beginnings of Islam. But what struck me was how, you know, Muhammad kept on emphasizing how Muslims should love each other. And, you know, they'd all been killing each other before that. All the different tribes in what is now Saudi Arabia were all killing each other for hundreds of years. Muhammad comes along and unites them all with this one religion. And, you know, it just struck me how revolutionary that thought was to the people in Arabia at that particular time. And in the same way, you know, Jesus Christ, who of course said these things 600 years before Muhammad said them, and Jesus Christ was the Son of God, Muhammad was just a mere mortal, an ordinary person. But when Jesus Christ said this, it must have been truly revolutionary as well. You know, the Roman Empire was particularly cruel and despotic. The fourth beast of Daniel chapter 7 and so aggressive and so violent that not even one animal could depict the Roman Empire. One animal depicted the Babylonian Empire, the Persian Empire, and the Greek Empire, but the Roman Empire was a composite of those animals because it was so violent. And here comes along Jesus Christ, the Son of God, and who says, "A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another." Now, even for the Jews, who, of course, many of them believed in the Old Testament, most of them didn't, because most of them were not really practicing their religion at that time, but I think many of them would have been aware of what it says. But even to them, this was really something quite radical, because the emphasis had been on, it's quite radical, even though it is actually said in the Old Testament, but it was quite radical because the emphasis had been much more on other things, on like the Pharisees, for example. So he says, here's a new commandment I give to you, that you love one another. As I have loved you, that you also love one another. By this all will know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another. You know, I've got to say something here, and this is what inspired this sermon. Tomorrow we have this memorial in the afternoon. And Jay's mom made this comment to my wife over the phone. She said, I'm paraphrasing here, may not be the exact wording, but she said, "We've been overwhelmed at the outpouring of love from the church members following Jay's death." And, frankly, it made me feel really good inside to know that so many of you have expressed concern and offered help at this difficult time. Now, this is how it should be. But that comment really struck me because it ties in so much with what we just read in John 13:35. "By this all will know that my disciples, if you have love for one another." That is the way that we as Christians should be known. And so when you get a comment from somebody who, is not in our fellowship, she used to be, but not now, and this comment is made of just how overwhelmed the family has been at the outpouring of love from the church members, I think that's wonderful. And I felt something similar when I was at Donna West's funeral as well, and the visitation on Tuesday night, that, again, all this love and concern that is coming from people, and it's wonderful to see that. And I think we've grown a great deal in that particular area over the years because, a lot of people left 10 years ago in all the confusion that took place as a result of the changes that were made in Pasadena. But I think, many people did not feel the love in their different churches that should have been there. And, I hope we've grown in that area. I believe we have grown in that area. And I know we've grown in that area. But, hopefully other people have too in other areas. Look at James 1 and verse 27. Because some of these other scriptures will help us to think about these things too. In James 1 verse 27 it says, "Pure and undefiled religion before God and the Father is this: to visit orphans and widows in their trouble and to keep oneself unspotted from the world." So, it is important for us to keep the commandments of God. Now, we've always emphasized that, and rightly, that was something that needed to be emphasized. When you think about it, in traditional Christianity, mainstream Christianity, the commandments have not been emphasized. So there was a need, I think, for a great deal of emphasis to be placed upon keeping the commandments, and especially the fourth commandment, the Sabbath, which had not been observed. But not only should we keep ourselves unspotted from the world, we should also have the love which is mentioned here. Pure and undefiled religion before God and the Father is this: to visit orphans and widows in their trouble. Which is exactly what Karen's been going through with Jay's death. And of course Jay didn't have a dad either, so that is a factor here too. So, this verse is a verse that we should keep in mind and take to heart. Chapter 2 of James as well. Chapter 2, something else for us to think about here. Beginning in verse 14, "What does it profit, my brethren, if someone says he has faith but does not have works?" If we have a great deal of faith Again, I think back to the past. You know, I've known many people over the years in the church who have been rather unbalanced. I think of one man in particular. I'm sure I've used him before as an example, but this was over in England. When I visited him, you know, he told me proudly that he spent 5 hours a day studying the Bible. He also had a full-time job. And I was about to ask him, well, you know, how do you manage to find time for your family? When his teenage boy came into the room, and the teenage boy had, bright orange and purple hair and rings sticking out of all kinds of unmentionable places. And I thought, well, obviously he doesn't have any time with his son. That was my immediate thought, you know, that the family was being neglected while he was studying the Bible. And, you know, that's not right. I mean, certainly we need to be studying the Bible, but we can't neglect our families in order to do that. But, the emphasis here is, in this particular passage, is pointing out to us that our faith must be a living faith that includes works, you know, which means demonstrations of the love that Jesus Christ tells us to have. What does it profit, my brethren, if someone says he has faith but does not have works? Can faith save him? If a brother or sister is naked and destitute of daily food, and one of you says to them, depart in peace, be warmed and filled, but you do not give them the things which are needed for the body, what does it profit? I thought of this passage again, watching the film on Islam, because this is a strong emphasis on the Islamic religion. And, you know, you can see why it was needed, because, you know, the poor were oppressed and people were suffering. And in our society, the poor are oppressed and people are suffering. This isn't an equitable society in which we live. And there's a lot of people who go without, who are suffering. And it says here, you know, what does it do? In fact, there was a letter in the Lancet State Journal a couple of days ago where somebody wrote a very critical letter about the religious right and said, you know, it's okay, they emphasize things like abortion and gay rights, and, you know, correctly, they say those things are wrong, but where is the compassion for the poor? When have they put pressure on the administration to do something to help the less fortunate people in our society? And that's a good question. And Jesus Christ is pointing that out here. If a brother or sister is naked and destitute of daily food, and one of you says to them, depart in peace, be warmed and filled, but you do not give them the things which are needed for the body, what does it profit? You know, what good is your Christianity, in other words? Thus also faith by itself, if it does not have works, is dead. You know, we may be believers, but if we're not showing love towards others, then what difference does it make? And if we're not giving to help others, what difference does it make? But someone will say, well, you have faith and I have works. So some people might be strong believers. They might spend a lot of time studying their Bibles, for example. They might have absolute faith in every one of the little details of things which are, which we understand as a church. And then they'll say, but you've got works. You're more the kind of the person who does things to help others. But, you know, I'll stick to my faith. Show me your faith without your works, and I will show you my faith by my works. You believe that there is one God. You do well. Even the demons believe and tremble. So even the demons believe that there is one God. I mean, they know the truth too. Satan knows the truth. But do you want to know, O foolish man, that faith without works is dead? Was not Abraham, our father, justified by works when he offered Isaac, his son, on the altar? Do you see that faith was working together with his works, and by works faith was made perfect? And the scripture was fulfilled, which says, Abraham believed God, and it was accounted to him for righteousness. And he was called a friend of God. You see then that a man is justified by works and not by faith only. Likewise, was not Rahab the harlot also justified by works when she received the messengers and sent them out another way? For as the body without the spirit is dead, so faith without works is dead also. So, you know, there has to be this demonstration of our faith. Christianity is an active religion and not something that, we keep to ourselves. 1 Corinthians chapter 13 emphasizes this point too. 1 Corinthians chapter 13. You know, in 2 Peter chapter 3 and verse 18, We're told to grow in grace and knowledge. And I believe we have been growing, and I'll come back to that in a few moments. But let's just look at this for a moment. I didn't have 1 Corinthians 13 in my notes, but I want to just turn here because it emphasizes this particular point. Though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels that have not love, I have become a sounding brass or a clanging cymbal. You know, and I think looking back, that was often a problem, that a lot of people were very strong on certain things like prophecy and so on, and you know, could be quite noisy about it. I think back to, you know, when I first came into the church, you know, I would share many of my new beliefs with my family, and, you know, I must have been like sounding like brass or a clanging cymbal, you know, to them, just making a lot of noise. Though I have the gift of prophecy and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and though I have all faith so that I can remove mountains but have not love, I am nothing. And though I bestow all my goods to feed the poor, and though I give my body to be burned, but have not love, it profits me nothing. Love suffers long and is kind. Love does not envy. Love does not parade itself, is not puffed up, does not behave rudely, does not seek its own, is not provoked, thinks no evil, does not rejoice in iniquity, but rejoices in the truth, bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never fails. But whether there are prophecies, they will fail. Whether there are tongues, they will cease. Whether there is knowledge, it will vanish away. You know, all of those things do change. Even our understanding of some things has changed over the years, slightly, not terribly, not dramatically. But often we've grown in certain areas and changed our emphasis in some other areas. But, you know, love is something which never changes, and it should never fail. So 2 Peter chapter 3 and verse 18 says, "Grow in the grace and knowledge of our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ." When Jesus Christ returns, many incredible things happen. But there's one in particular I want to focus on right now. Look at Revelation chapter 19. Revelation chapter 19. Beginning in verse 7. This is taking us to the time where Jesus Christ returns. And in verse 7 it says this, "Let us be glad and rejoice and give him glory, for the marriage of the Lamb has come, and his wife has made herself ready. And to her it was granted to be arrayed in fine linen, clean and bright, for the fine linen is the righteous acts of the saints." You know, again, referring back to how faith without works is dead, this is referring to the righteous acts of the saints, of the people in God's church. Then he said to me, "Write, blessed are those who are called to the marriage supper of the Lamb." And he said, "These are the true sayings of God." So here is the marriage supper of Jesus Christ to the church. You know, Jesus Christ in Ephesians 5, that I read from earlier on, is likened to the bridegroom, and the church is likened to the bride in the marriage. And the marriage of Jesus Christ to the church takes place when he returns. Now this week I've spent some time thinking about all the things that have happened to us in the last 10 plus years. But let's go back further. Next month, January 16th, it will be 20 years since Mr. Armstrong died. 20 years. You will remember at the time, he said that his role had been to preach the gospel to the world, and that his successor would have to prepare the bride for the marriage to Jesus Christ. That's what Mr. Armstrong said at the time. Of course, things did not go at all as H.W.A. or others thought that they would. I think in Mr. Armstrong's mind, his successor would be the one to prepare the church for the marriage of Jesus Christ. He never realized that his successor and those around him would reject the Sabbath and the holy days, and the church would be shattered and scattered, and incredible damage was done. However, looking back, I think that in a roundabout way, the bride has been prepared for the marriage and still is being prepared for the marriage. is the way things happened was not the way any of us would have thought 20 years ago. I don't think any of us 20 years ago would have guessed that that was the way things were going to work themselves out. But you know, the problems that we went through, the upheaval we went through as a result of some of the leaders of the church changing their views on the Sabbath and the holy days, the upheaval that led to and the scattering that followed has led to a great deal of growth, spiritual growth, growing in grace and knowledge amongst the various people who have been scattered. And I'm not just talking about people in United. I mean, there are people in other groups as well who have also been learning some of these things. I think different people went in different directions for all kinds of different reasons. You know, we've all had to grow and we've all had to work things through in our minds. And, you know, I saw evidence of this at the visitation and at the funeral on Wednesday because there were people there from many different groups and talking to different people. You realize, you know, we're all kind of changing as we go through all of this. What it's all going to lead to, I don't know. But I do feel that God is in charge. He knows what he's doing. And I'm convinced that everything will work out for the best. You know, Romans 8:28, all things work together for good to those who love God. And I'm convinced everything will work out. But, you know, it hasn't all been bad. It's been difficult. It's been challenging. It's been stressful. We're all somewhat older and hopefully wiser. Look at Matthew chapter 25. But we need to remember that the bride, the church, is being prepared for the marriage of Jesus Christ. And, you know, this is the most important event that is going to take place in the future. The second coming of Jesus Christ, the establishment of the kingdom, the banishment of Satan, the beginning of the millennial rule, and the marriage supper of Jesus Christ to the church. In fact, the day that Christ returns is also the day when the saints will be resurrected and will receive eternal life. And then, you know, presumably a few days later, the marriage supper of the Lamb will take place. And it is by invitation only. It's not a wedding that you can gate crash, you know. This is, you know, strictly controlled, as Charles and Di's wedding was in 1981. Only this one will last. Look at Matthew 25, beginning in verse 1. Then the kingdom of heaven shall be likened to 10 virgins who took their lamps and went out to meet the bridegroom. Now remember again, in Revelation 17, when it talks about the saints and the marriage supper, you know, the bride of Jesus Christ is pictured as a virgin dressed in white, which was a symbol of purity. Today, you get girls who are 7 months pregnant walking down the aisle in white dresses. That is not the way it used to be. You only wore white if you, you know, if you were a virgin. But, you know, it's not like that anymore. And, of course, that is not the way that it should be. But that is, in biblical terminology, the picture that we're given is of the true church, like a virgin, dressed in white. The symbolism with virginity ties in with the description of the false church in Revelation 17, where the false church is described as a harlot. The false church will do anything, basically, will sell herself just to get more followers. That's what it comes down to. Compromise with God's word for money. The true church is not like that. The true church keeps the commandments of Jesus. Revelation 12 shows that clearly, the difference between the two churches. So the true church is pictured as a virgin who keeps herself pure, doesn't sell herself for personal advantage, but is keeping herself pure for the coming of the bridegroom, which is Jesus Christ. So here now is the parable of the wise and foolish virgins. The kingdom of heaven shall be likened to 10 virgins who took their lamps and went out to meet the bridegroom. Now, there's a lot in this, but I just want to focus on something related to the point that I'm making here about ruling well in love. Now, 5 of them were wise and 5 were foolish. So here we've got people in the church. You know, half are wise and half are foolish in this parable here. Whether that's meant to show that 50% of people in the church are wise and 50% are foolish, I don't know. I mean, you know, I don't know that. But obviously there's some of each. Those who were foolish took their lamps and took no oil with them, but the wise took oil in their vessels with their lamps. But while the bridegroom was delayed, they all slumbered and slept. Now, you know, that brings us to this last 20 years. You know, a lot of people 30 years ago thought that Christ would return very quickly. And many people thought he would return while Mr. Armstrong was still alive. Of course, that didn't happen. So while the bridegroom was delayed, you know, this period of time, at the end time, when Christ has not returned, they all slumbered and slept. And at midnight a cry was heard, "Behold, the bridegroom is coming, go out to meet him." Then all those virgins arose and trimmed their lamps, and the foolish said to the wise, "Give us some of your oil, for our lamps are going out." So the wise answered, saying, "No, lest there should not be enough for us and you. But go rather to those who sell, and buy for yourselves." And while they went to buy, the bridegroom came, and those who were ready went in with him to the wedding, and the door was shut. Afterward, the other virgins came also, saying, "Lord, Lord, open to us." But he answered and said, "Assuredly, I say to you, I do not know you. Watch therefore, for you know neither the day nor the hour in which the Son of Man is coming." Now, a whole sermon could be given on this one parable because there's so much meaning in it. But I think the basic meaning we need to grasp from it is that not everybody is ready when Christ returns. Not all of those who claim to be followers of Jesus Christ will be ready. So Jesus Christ is preparing the church for the marriage, but not everybody is allowing themselves to be prepared. I think that's one way we can put it. Not everybody is going through some of the changes, some of the growth in grace and knowledge, some of the increased understanding which God wants us to have at this time prior to the second coming of Jesus Christ. And I believe we've gone through an incredible period of growth over the past few years. Not growth in numbers. It's kind of interesting. The church, during this period of turmoil, has not grown in numbers, although we have had some new people come. But there was a time when I first came into the church in the late 1960s, the church grew at 30% a year. And that was a phenomenal rate of growth for any church to grow at a rate like that. And a lot of emphasis was placed on numbers, and I don't think we should do that at all. There was a lot of growth at that particular time, numerically, but I think during this period of time where there has been some turmoil, the growth has been more in individuals, as people have had to work things through in their minds, and as we've come to a better understanding of where we were wrong before. I mean, one of the first things that I realized during the time that we went through our split was that many people who had been in the church for many years had come to a very good understanding of some of what we taught, but we had not emphasized enough grace. We certainly had not. And we had a lot of people who really did not understand grace. That concept wasn't there in a lot of people. It was in some, but not in a lot of people. And so that was one omission there. I think also, looking back, we tried often to unite everybody by making everybody agree to every little point of doctrine. And that is not the way to unite a congregation. Certainly, we all need to be agreed on the trunk of the tree, that the Sabbath and the holy days should be observed. We need to agree on some other things too. But some of the little things, I don't think it matters too much. What unites a congregation more than anything is the love that Jesus Christ talked about. And that's where the emphasis needed to be. It was lacking, I think. Again, not with everybody, but I think it was greatly lacking, and that's where we needed to change. And that's illustrated further on in chapter 25 of Matthew, verse 31. If you go here, verse 31, because again, it comes back again to works and to love. There is a difference between the two, but the two also come together in some respects. You know, this is active concern for others and being actively involved in other people's lives in order to help them. When the Son of Man comes in His glory and all the holy angels with Him, then He will sit on the throne of His glory. All the nations will be gathered before Him, and He will separate them one from another as a shepherd divides his sheep from the goats. And He will set the sheep on His right hand, but the goats on the left. Then the King will say to those on His right hand, Come, you blessed of My Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave Me food. I was thirsty, and you gave Me drink. I was a stranger, and you took Me in. I was naked, and you clothed Me. I was sick, and you visited Me. I was in prison, and you came to Me. Then the righteous will answer Him, saying, Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you drink? When did we see you a stranger and take you in, or naked and clothe you? Or when did we see you sick or in prison and come to you? And the King will answer and say to them, Assuredly I say to you, inasmuch as you did it to one of the least of these My brethren, you did it to Me. Then He will also say to those on the left hand, Depart from Me, you cursed, into the everlasting fire prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was hungry, and you gave Me no food. I was thirsty, and you gave Me no drink. I was a stranger, and you did not take Me, and naked, and you did not clothe Me, sick and in prison, and you did not visit Me. Then they also will answer Him, saying, Lord, when did we see you hungry, or thirsty, or a stranger, or naked, or sick, or in prison, and did not minister to you? Then He will answer them, saying, Assuredly, I say to you, inasmuch as you did not do it to one of the least of these, you did not do it to Me. And these will go away into everlasting punishment, but the righteous into eternal life. That's an interesting passage there, but it shows that, you know, the way that we treat others is a determining factor in whether we're going to be in the kingdom or not. Because the way we treat others, Jesus Christ, as far as He is concerned, that is the way that we would treat Him. There's an analogy there. So, you know, we have to treat everybody as if that other person is Jesus Christ. Which is not always easy to do, because some people can be, you know, a pain, to put it mildly. You know, but it requires a great deal of patience. It requires a great depth of conversion, and it requires a great deal of love, long suffering, all those qualities that you know, we see mentioned in the scriptures. But you know, we certainly have to have that kind of an attitude towards other people, and I believe we've grown a great deal in this. And you know, I think you know, I saw that this week at the funeral, and certainly that comment that Karen made, you know, those things are very encouraging. And I think these are things that Jesus Christ wanted us to see before we're ready for the marriage, which takes place at His return. You know, when I read this particular passage, I think of missionaries in Africa. There's a lot of people go there from the United States, and from even from England and other countries as well, and they want to make a difference. And they keep on giving and giving and giving physically, because they take passages like this to heart, and they want to give, so they help people with their, you know, with clothing, and they help people with food. But you know, they don't teach people that they need to change and that they need to keep the commandments in order for Africa to change. And so that's where they fail. Because unless you teach people to live according to God's law, you won't solve the problems. So you can give all this money, all this help, and it really isn't going to make a difference. But I think we erred too much on the other side for a long time, because you know, we came out of churches where there was no emphasis on the laws of God. So we had to emphasize those. But sometimes it came over as rather harsh. And, you know, we needed to demonstrate love, and there's a time also, you know, for us to be providing for people, as we're able to do. And, you know, so I think we're trying to get the balance now, and I think that's very important, and it's something that we each need to work on in our own lives. Matthew 22. Matthew 22. There's a lot here to think about, but you know, I really do feel that I think we can look back now over these 10 years and see a great deal of growth, and it's wonderful to see that. And you know, I can't speak for every congregation, But I certainly feel that we've come a long way, and I want to encourage everybody to keep on in that same direction, and to be open to understand other things that God may want us to learn also before everything comes to an end. In verse 35 of Matthew 22, one of them, a lawyer, asked him a question, testing him and saying, "Teacher, which is the great commandment in the law?" You know, what is the most important thing? Jesus said to him, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind. This is the first and great commandment. And the second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets." So, you know, both are important. And again, to use that analogy in Africa, you know, the missionaries emphasized the second part a great deal, but, you know, they're not telling people to keep the commandments, and if they don't keep the commandments, Africa will always be poor and backward. It will never change. You know, both are important. And I think, you know, we had a time when we emphasized the Sabbath and the holy days, and again, those should be kept. They're a part of God's law. You cannot really know God or understand his plan for mankind unless you keep the Sabbath and the holy days. So in no way is this meant to water those things down at all. In no way does it reduce their significance or their importance. But at the same time, the second is like unto it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. And, you know, I think that's an area we did have to grow in, individually and collectively as a church. There was a good article last week. I wish I'd brought it with me. I'm not even sure if I still got it. It was in the Lansing State Journal in the religious column on Saturday last week. And sometimes that religious column raises my blood pressure, so it's not good for me. But last week's did have some interesting points. And one point that was brought out was that when a stranger comes through your door at church, it said you have 1 hour to show them what a difference your congregation can make to their lives. And I thought, you know, that's an interesting thought. You know, let's understand that the vast majority of people who do come through that door, if we've not seen them before, already believe pretty much what we believe, or they wouldn't be here. I mean, who goes to church on a Saturday, you know? They'd go on a Sunday morning when it's more convenient, you know, and when other people do it. So if they're coming through that door, they already agree with most of what we believe. So then it's up to us to make a good impression. And I've been thinking about this. I mean, last week we had somebody come we hadn't seen for many years. You know, in the scattering that took place, he had gone to a different organization, to ourselves, and last week he came, paid us a visit. He's apparently going to one or two others as well to check them all out. And, you know, did we create a good impression? I mean, were we friendly? You know, I know many people were because I saw that myself, but you know, I know sometimes when a stranger comes in, it's easy to kind of hold back and think, well, I don't think I'll go up and say anything. I'll leave it to everybody else. But, you know, really, you know, irregular, you know, they really need to feel loved and wanted. And then a very positive impression is given. I had an individual call me this week who was thinking of coming to our church service. And this particular person said that they had already approached one of the other groups, and the minister made it clear that their spouse could not attend because the spouse was not a believer. And so I was asked, you know, well, can my husband come? I said, you know, we have an open door policy. Anybody can come. As long as people come in peace, anybody can come to our church service. And we'll make them feel welcome. And, you know, she was really pleased to hear that. And I think that policy is a good one. Now, we never used to have that policy. You know, in worldwide, that was not the policy. You know, before anybody could come to church, they had to fill out forms in triplicate, and we had to visit. Not exactly, you know, I'm exaggerating a bit, but, you know, we used to visit people, make sure they were perfect before they could come. Because if they were perfect, why should they come? You know, you come to church because you realize you're not perfect and you need God and you need the sacrifice that Jesus Christ made. So if you're already perfect, you may as well go somewhere else. You know, it's kind of a contradiction there. But, You know, certainly we've grown in that area, and I think our open door policy is a sensible one and a right one. And if anybody wants to come, you know, they can come as long as they come in peace. I think where we have to draw the line is if somebody is coming to try to get us to go somewhere else, you know, which has happened. 10 years ago, that was happening. We had people come in from other groups that were trying to get us to go and join them, and I think that was wrong. That was unethical. I always thought that was a little bit like going into Myers and shouting out, everybody, why don't you go to Kroger, because it's cheaper. You know, it's unethical to do that, and we shouldn't do that. But, you know, Gary Petty, who's the man who is the host on our radio program, was telling me that his congregation wanted to help when Hurricane Katrina struck. And his congregation's in San Antonio, and a lot of the people from New Orleans were brought over to the San Antonio and Houston areas afterwards. And, you know, many of them were in, I think this was in one particularly big school, and his church wanted to get involved in disaster relief. And a lot of them volunteered to do this, and they went down to this particular school. They called up first and said, oh yeah, we need help. So they went down there, and when they got down there, they were overwhelmed because they were the only church that had volunteered to help. Nobody else had offered to help. No other church organization. So, you know, as soon as they got in there, the people who were already there organizing this, the American Red Cross, just said, well, we need you to do this, that, and the other. And they basically let our congregation from San Antonio take over because there was nobody else helping. And, you know, he was talking about what an incredible effect it had on the whole congregation and how the whole congregation, as a result of this, changed because of their involvement in this. Now, I'm not praying for a disaster like that in Michigan, but if we have one, I hope we would do the same thing and get involved. And, you know, it certainly is an area in which, you know, we can contribute. It all comes down again to John 13:35, and I'll close there. John 13:35, and, you know, this is a verse we should commit to memory because this is the identifying sign of who God's true people are. By this all will know that you are my disciples, as you have love for one another, and especially for each other within the church. And, you know, for people also in the wider church environment, in other words, in, amongst the churches of God, but also for people in the community. You know, when we show love, it kind of filters down. And it'll have a positive effect upon everybody that we come into contact with. I know, you know, I don't think I do this all the time, but I try. I mean, I try to kind of brighten up people's lives and try to show love and compassion to other people. And, you know, I think we all need to try and do that. And I know that many of you do. And I really, again, just want to commend everybody on the terrific compliment that was paid us this week as a result of people's outpouring of love over the situation in which, you know, Jay's mom has found herself. And I know you'll have an opportunity tomorrow to show that even more. So, you know, we need to look for those opportunities to make a difference and to fulfill what Jesus Christ said here, and also to show that we are growing in grace and knowledge and coming to a better understanding of how we should conduct ourselves in preparation for the marriage supper to Jesus Christ.